Roughly two-thirds of American households are home to a pet or pets of some kind, and among those pets are close to 100 million cats. We love our cats, even if we don't understand them fully. They are not complete mysteries, not by a long shot. Plenty of experts pay plenty of attention to cats, and a long list of them joined forces for a new big book called Decoding Your Cat. The ultimate experts explain common cat behaviors and reveal how to prevent or change unwanted ones. The book has three editors, Megan Herron, Deborah Horwitz, and Carlo Siracusa. Megan Herron is our guest, an associate professor at Ohio State University and the head of the Behavioral Medicine Service at the Veterinary Medical Center there. Getting to that point involved a three-year residency in behavioral medicine atop the veterinary degree. So a lot of work Megan Herron put in just to get to this point.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that.
Good to have you here. So so this book is like the official cat book of the ACVB. Would you explain what that is for the people who don't know it?
Sure. So the ACVB is the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. So we are a group of veterinarians, first and foremost, who went on to do special training in the field of veterinary behavior. So treating behavioral issues of companion animals, although we are educated in the treatment of other domesticated species like livestock and other, say, agriculture-based animals that have behavioral issues that may impact their welfare. But most of us tend to treat companion animals who are displaying behavioral issues in their homes, such as aggression, elimination problems, fears, phobias, separation anxiety, you name it, we are here to help.
Were you part of the official dog book, too, that came out before this one?
I was. I was one of the co-authors of that work. Came out in 2015, and, you know, this sequel, Decoding Your Cat, has been kind of a dream in the making, and it's really exciting to see it come to fruition and to be a much larger part of this book.
Yeah, it's very comprehensive and lots of detail in here and lots to talk about with our audience, and I'm sure I can see the phone ringing already. But it's right there in the foreword of the book. An example of a cat pooping on somebody's pillow. I mean, so when cats poop on your bathtub, your pillow, whatever, is it because they're angry?
That's a great question, and we hear that all the time. And I will say most of my clients coming to me whose cat is pooping or peeing in certain places that are less than desirable, most of them feel like it is out of spite or getting back at them for some reason. And really what it comes down to is that it's actually typically a much simpler message. So it is, in some cases, a form of communication. Our cats are trying to tell us something, but it isn't always as we think. So actually, in majority of these cases, particularly with cats pooping in places we don't like, it's actually a result of a medical problem. So some sort of pain or discomfort with going to the bathroom. In their little brain, they made the connection that it hurt or was really difficult to poop in that box that you wanted me to go in. And you know what? Your pillow is easy to access. It gets cleaned immediately, and felt quite safe. So, and if it didn't hurt that time, well, then they just taught themselves that that's their new litter box. So sometimes it's a lot simpler.
All right, so it's more of a comfort thing than a message thing.
In some cases, I mean, with cats that spray urine, say, like marking urine around the house, sometimes they do it as a message that they're really stressed out. And it could be stressed out based on your behavior and what you're doing. Doesn't necessarily mean they're mad at you or getting back at you. It's just a form of communication. So cats communicate with each other in a lot of ways, and scent and pheromonal messaging is a huge part of that. It's kind of their way of, you know, as one of our four grandmothers, Dr. Catherine Help, said, you know, pheromones in cats and scent marking in cats is like their version of email. Like, I can leave this message and I can leave, and this message is going to linger for a long time for all others to read. And so a lot of times they're just merely communicating how they're feeling about the certain situation, and all sorts of things can stress out cats that we would never think about. But again, often a medical reason for feeling uncomfortable or painful can be a big reason for that.
Well, in general, Megan, the dispelling of myths starts early in the book. Cats are not as solitary as we often give them credit or blame for.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. I mean, if you look at, you know, with all the development of colonies of cats out there, the feral cat colonies that are being supported by communities, and this isn't just a singleton cat wandering around. These are large groups. They're very matriarchal, so you'll have moms with their sisters and the cousins, you know, nursing on aunties and moms and really mingling and living together, you know, throughout their lives of these sort of large groups of sometimes related, but sometimes intermingling groups of and families of cats. So by nature, they are social creatures. Now, it really, you know, out in the wild, when they're not living directly off of humans, how they live is going to depend on their resources. So if you have a cat where someone isn't feeding them, right? These communities of feral cats are supported by people feeding them. If no one's feeding them and they're having to survive on that, you know, random mouse or mole, then they're probably going to live more on their own because their prey is small and not abundant. But in their nature, when resources are abundant, it behooves them to live as a group. Okay. I think the issue is that we often get kittens past their socialization window. And so if they were taken away from mom and litter mates or either weren't around a lot of people at a young age, then they didn't learn how to do that. So I think some of our cats end up seeming solitary because they didn't learn how to live in a group at a very young age.
Okay, we'll talk about that socialization window. Apparently, 2 to 7 weeks, really important for kittens. We'll get into what needs to happen at that time and sometimes doesn't, as we're hearing. Megan Herron, one of the 3 editors with Deborah Horowitz and Carlo Siracusa of Decoding Your Cat. The ultimate experts explain common cat behaviors and reveal how to prevent or change unwanted ones. That's right, cats can be trained, and so can you, for that matter, to recognize what they're telling you. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. I kind of lost count after a while, Megan. How many different people did write articles or chapters for the book?
Oh, gosh, we have...
You lost count, too. Okay.
16 authors. I'm trying to keep track. 16, uh-huh. No, actually more than that.
Uh-huh.
20, okay. 21. My goodness, we had a lot.
You did, but you know, it's very consistent. Each chapter is laid out the same, some of the same sidebars and the same summations at the end. This is really a useful book, and I'm surprised not just that cats can be trained, but also I notice a heavy emphasis on the fact that humans can know better. They can be trained to recognize what goes on with cats.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I took some of this to heart already. An example here is that, you know, the cat comes and sits on my lap when I'm busy watching TV and not paying much attention to him, and I'll just mindlessly stroke him, and sometimes he'll just take a chomp out of me, and I'm not sure why. And after reading the book, I realized, keep an eye on him, and he might not want to be stroked past a certain point.
Yeah, he wants to be close to you. He just doesn't want you to touch him right then or right there. You got to learn the boundaries here.
Well, that's an interesting point, though, is that you really have to know, you have to keep in mind what the cat likes and knows.
Yeah. Yeah. And every cat is different. So I think a lot of people are surprised if they had a cat growing up, you know, allow them to do anything and they can, you know, my gosh, when I was 5 years old, I dressed up my cat in my doll's clothes and did all sorts of awful things that I try not to let my children do now. And my cat was very, very tolerant, but your average cat is not. And some of them have a very small window of how they like to be pet, where they like to be pet, and for how long. And they, you know, they can't just say, excuse me, sir, I'm not comfortable with this now. They have to use other means of communicating. And we tend to listen when they show us their teeth or we feel their teeth on us. We tend to respond. So they learn. So it works.
They do. It works. So they've trained us.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So you were talking about pheromones before. I mean, how much of what a cat communicates are we capable of perceiving or not capable of perceiving, I guess, for the flip side?
Yeah, well, certainly pheromones are not something that we as humans are able to detect, or really other species. So pheromones are an interspecies phenomenon. So dogs are going to detect dog pheromones. Cats can detect and read and interpret other cat pheromones, horses, rabbits, you name it. I mean, for humans, you know, it's pretty vestigial. Our veromonasal organs is really vestigial. I mean, it's not really active, although, you know, you can read the stories about women living in groups and what happens there. So there's suspicion that you know, there is some sort of pheromonal communication with people, but it's certainly not something we're conscious of, which is very different in cats. They're very aware of. They know where to look for them. You know, when cats scratch things, so unfortunately, sometimes that's our furniture, but they like to leave a big mess, right? Visually, they tear that couch apart. They leave these huge frays because they want other cats to see, like, hey, look, there's a message here. It's kind of like, you've got mail. And the other cats know, oh, here's something that's been disrupted visually. I know I should go there and I should smell it. And then I'm going to pick up both scent and pheromonal messages there. Now, pheromones are different than scents because they are what we call non-volatile, so they don't evaporate quickly. They stick around. They stick to that environment for days, sometimes weeks, if there's nothing there to wash it away. They detect that differently. So in cats, that message is actually received through their mouth. So they have these little entrances behind their canine teeth, the little passageway that allows those pheromones to access that, what we call the veromonasal organ, which then communicates with the part of the brain that detects that. Now, we as people don't have those holes. Don't go looking in the mirror behind your canine.
Right.
We don't have that. We don't have those, but for cats, they do, and it's very well developed, and they have this whole repertoire of pheromones throughout their body, including, you know, their cheeks. So when cats are rubbing their cheek on you, or what we call bunting, they're actually leaving a message there, especially for themselves when they're there late, it says, oh, this person's okay. I feel safe here. I feel comfortable and content here. And so when they're cheek marking around you in the furniture, that's a really good sign that you're okay in their book. And then when next time they're in that environment, they will detect those pheromones that they left behind and say, oh, yeah, I marked this already as safe. We're good here. Or potentially to a message to another cat that, hey, this place is okay. Nothing bad happened here. But then quite the opposite can happen with other pheromones. So say through anal glands, through their foot pads, where they have pheromones that can communicate, hey, this place is scary. So particularly at the veterinary clinic, if a cat gets super scared, if they have a painful procedure done, or they're really sick and stressed out, they're going to leave messages all over that place. Like, beware, get out. This place is dangerous, which is why we as veterinarians have to work so hard to try to make that veterinary exam experience as pleasant as possible. And also be aware that we need to be wiping down our surfaces to prevent that communication between cats, and also utilize, there are synthetic pheromone products, which you talk a lot about in this book, the Feel-Away products that can mimic these sort of appeasing or content pheromones to kind of send the message that this place is safe, you don't need to be afraid. So some really, really great use of pheromones, both for inter-cat communication, but also how we as humans can use a synthetic version to try to create messages that we want our cats to receive.
Megan Herron is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the editor with Deborah Horowitz and Carlos Siracusa of the book Decoding Your Cat, The Ultimate Experts Explain Common Cat Behaviors and Reveal How to Prevent or Change Unwanted Ones. When we're watching cats deliver messages, body posture messages, and there's a whole bunch of pictures in the book too, some of which are interspecies things, intraspecies, mm-hmm. I guess is what I'm trying to say, that rubbing all their butts together and stuff like that. But what are the kinds of things that they use in approaching humans that tell us some things? I mean, the whole straight up tail, is that a welcoming thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's really cool is that this is something unique to domesticated cats. So if you watch lions, tigers, cheetahs, they do not do that. So when a cat is approaching you with a tail up, sort of that flagpole tail, that is a sign of what we call, it's an affiliative sign of, I want to get closer to you in a friendly manner. I'm feeling good. My intentions are friendly. And it's really something that developed as cats were, at least we can say, semi-domesticated and formed their relationship with people over the past few thousands of years, because that's not something we'll see wild cats do to each other. No other species does that but our domesticated kitties. So it's pretty cool to see something that actually developed as their relationship with humans formed over the years. That's their way of communicating friendliness. But again, there's all sorts of other ways that they communicate with their vocalization. And with their body language, and as you talked about earlier, with their mouth, with their teeth, with their claws, which are very easily misinterpreted, which is why our first chapter, The Language of Meow, is where we started, because we've got to really, it's really hard to know what a cat is trying to tell you. It's really difficult to then communicate your intentions if we don't understand how they communicate and how they're likely to interpret what we are saying and doing.
How consistent are vocalizations from cat to cat? I mean, does the, you know, the deep roar mean the same thing for all cats as the lighter meow does?
Sure, I would say it's fairly consistent. So the motivations behind those vocalizations. Now, I certainly think there's going to be great variation in how often they will use them, and certain personalities of cats that may be either more needy or more social are going to utilize those behaviors. But I also think that there's learning. Certain cats may learn that certain vocalizations lead to a consequence that is desirable for them. So they may then, in effect, use them more often. But the initial motivation behind them, I think, is essentially the same for the most part between cats. You're not going to see them fake it or hiss at you because they're happy.
Okay.
A hiss definitely means I am afraid across the board, right? There's really no other way to interpret that.
But, you know, it's interesting because purring, I mean, that's not really a vocalization, I guess, is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, but, I mean, it's a vibration. We can hear it. We have that ability to perceive it. And that's probably one where I think we talk about it as sort of comfort seeking. And in most cases, I think with our own cats, we consider purring as a sign of contentment. I'm feeling comfortable. Mm-hmm. Or I'm enjoying the state of comfort in which I find myself, and I want it to continue. But we can also see this happen in situations where cats are feeling nervous and are wanting to be comforted. So something we might see at a vet clinic, a cat that clearly is showing other body language signals such as, you know, dilated pupils, ears flat back, the tail is puffed up and maybe swishing a little bit. They're sort of crunching down, squinting their eyes, trying to avoid us, yet they're purring. Mm-hmm. And I think our best interpretation of that is they are seeking comfort from their people of, I'm nervous here, I want to get away, but I need to be comforted. And so sometimes we will see what we call that nervous purr in those situations. But I think for the most part in a home, if your cat, I mean, it's why we have to look at the whole body, right? It's not just what you hear, but it's also what you see. You know, so a cat that is, you know, lying in the sun, limbs fully extended, the pupils are that nice little almond slit, you know, because the light is high, their ears are just kind of forward but relaxed. There's no sort of puffed up tail, puffed up body. They just kind of look happy, relaxed, and soft. They're not squished together. They're not moving their head away. If they're purring in that situation, I can guarantee you it's because they're feeling comfortable and they want that to continue.
Megan Herron, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an associate professor at Ohio State University, heads the Behavioral Medicine Service at the Veterinary Medical Center there, is one of three editors with Deborah Horowitz and Carlo Siracusa, and 21 authors of Decoding Your Cat, The Ultimate Experts Explain Common Cat Behaviors and Reveal How to Prevent or Change Unwanted Ones. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Share your cat story. Ask your cat question. 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here is John in Grants Pass, not the grumpy kind. Hi, John. Whoop. John.
Are you there?
Ah, there we go. Yes.
Hi. So, why do dogs eat cat poop?
That's a great question.
All right, we can barely hear you, John. We'll have to leave it at the question.
I heard it. He said, why do dogs eat cat poop? Is that correct?
Yes. Kitty Roca, as some people call it in my experience.
Yes. Well, you know, the answer is quite simple. So cats are what we call obligate carnivores, and they need a diet that is primarily meat. And so meat, when it's digested at that level, there's still a level of that exists in their poop. And so it is attractive to our canine friends, fortunately.
Okay.
So it's really just as simple as their diet. And dogs are a little more omnivorous than cats are, so they don't have quite the high meat content requirement in their dog food. Although I think some dogs do find dog poop appealing, but typically not because of the protein content. There's probably something else going on. But great question. We get it all the time. But yeah, those little Tootsie Rolls in the litter box are just appealing because of what cats eat.
Indeed. Okay. So I want to come back to the cats and messages, the ways they indicate what's going on with them. Do they send some mixed signals? You know, for example, like we learn in the book that exposing the belly is not an invitation to rub. So like, what kinds of things are they telling us with that?
I think, you have to look at the whole cat. I think some cats, when they are feeling really relaxed and comfortable, because the belly is a vulnerable spot on their body, you know, they may expose their belly. They may be stretching just as a form of comfort and relaxation. It does not necessarily mean they want to be touched in that vulnerable spot, right? And so you may see this belly exposure. It's sort of a form of, hey, I trust you. I'm feeling good. But we sort of violate that trust when we then scratch them on their belly because it is actually a very sensitive part of their body and a very vulnerable part of their body. And while there are a handful of cats that may enjoy it or may have learned to enjoy it, on average, most cats do not feel comfortable being touched there, and most are going to respond with that sort of grab me with my claws and bite that hand that's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not necessarily a mixed signal. I think it's a misinterpreted signal would be a better way to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are cats that you can find mixed signals that because emotionally they're conflicted. So, for example, if they're nervous about a new person being in their house, they may kind of check them out. They may cheek rub on them, which is typically a sign of I'm feeling safe. But then they may turn around and nip at them if they try to touch them. Or they may intermittently hiss and walk away and then come up, sniff, and rub on them because they're in a conflict. I think they're just sort of wearing their hearts on their sleeves, literally. Like, at this moment, I'm not sure about you, and I'm vacillating between interest and like and, you know, mistrust and reservations about you. And you will see that be expressed through these vacillating body language signals, which is why cats are so cool, because if you really know how to read their signals, you will see this huge variety displayed in front of you.
Mm-hmm. But now there are some cases in which they will hide what's going on with them. As you point out, since they are prey animals, they tend mm-hmm. to hide illness. So how do you pick up on a cat that is ailing enough to be taken to the vet?
Sure. And I think, you know, the word hide may not be perfectly accurate, because I think they have signals. They are just subtle, because they don't necessarily want to attract a great deal of attention. But for the astute owner, we should, when we're paying attention, we should be able to see these subtle changes. For example, a cat that is having some osteoarthritic pain, some arthritis that's developing, which is actually, as we're doing more studies, much more common in cats than we gave them credit for, because they aren't necessarily limping. They aren't coming up to you holding that paw up like, hey, I'm hurting right now. But what they're doing is they're changing their patterns ever so slightly. So they may not be jumping up to the top of that cat tree, which used to be their favorite perch. They may elect not to use a litter box if it's all the way down the stairs and around the corner, or if they have to jump over a gate to access it. Or if they previously would greet you by jumping on your kitchen counter to, you know, rub their face on your face, and they're not doing that anymore. It's more the absence of these behaviors that may have existed that they aren't demonstrating anymore. Just subtle signs that they're painful. They're not feeling as comfortable. You know, you can also see subtle changes in how they interact with you. So a cat that maybe once was very needy, followed you everywhere, suddenly stops doing that, starts retreating a bit more, is hiding in places they don't usually hide. I would be concerned that they're not feeling well and they're retreating for that reason. And same with the flip side, a cat that was typically reserved and independent is now suddenly very needy and following you everywhere. You know, is there physically something going on with them, or are they responding, you know, with, you know, COVID-19 quarantines and all of us being at home? I think a lot of people talk to me about their cats changing suddenly, either from being highly social or being highly reclusive and sort of moving to the opposite of that, because this major change in our schedules is either stressful for them or it's just different. And so their behaviors are changing as well.
You've probably seen the same cartoons I've seen about the reaction of the family pets to the people being home. The dogs are like, oh boy, this is great. You're here. The cats are like, you're going back to work when?
Yeah, exactly. Although I bet you there's some dogs that can that too.
Oh yeah, that's right. The ones who are like, no, you've walked me 5 times already today. Stop.
Yeah, or those of us with small children whose only source of entertainment for weeks was the family pet. Sometimes they need their own escape, dogs
indeed.
And cats alike.
Let's come back and talk about cats as kittens and the window of socialization. 2 to 7 weeks, critical time for a kitten. What should happen in that time, Megan?
Yeah, so really, and this is based on, you know, years of research looking at what are the critical windows for cats to sort of accept, you know, their own and accept other social beings and things in their environment as safe, you know, because the brain in both dogs and cats is set up to have this window of opportunity where, you know, in theory, their mother teaches them and shows them the world and says, this is what's safe for you. This is what you should respond to without being fearful in your world. And if I didn't show it to you at that young age, it's potentially dangerous and you should be afraid of it and potentially use aggression to protect yourself from it. And so if cats didn't have exposure to children, to dogs, to loud noises, to vacuum cleaners, right? All these things that we take for granted and don't really see as alarming. If a cat was not exposed to it during that window, they are going to see it as dangerous. They are going to see it as something to be afraid of and may use aggression against it to protect themselves from it. And with cats, you know, that critical period we suspect is between 2 and 7 weeks, although recent evidence suggests that this window can go as far as 12 weeks of age. I mean, I certainly know from personal mm-hmm. experience, I have found feral kittens at 8, 9, 10 weeks of age who were completely feral, not around, it was very clear, had not been around people. And with a matter of a couple of weeks, I was able to bring them around and they were able to be social with people.
Megan Herron, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The book is Decoding Your Cat, of which she is one of 3 editors. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1:05. Megan, the whole idea of cats as being easier than dogs, like you just need to set up, you know, food and water dishes in a litter box, but you're obviously the ACVB feels a bit differently.
Oh, sure. I think it's a common misconception that cats are just easy, low maintenance beings. And, you know, because we don't have to walk them every day, somehow that makes them easy. But I'll tell you, the cat is much less removed from their wild ancestor than our canine companions are. So if you look at the physique of, you know, the African wild cow or a cat living in the wild that we suspect has a common ancestor from our domesticated species, they look identical and they behave very similarly. So these normal natural behaviors like hunting, scratching, chewing, climbing, they still exist in our feline companions. And so if we are not providing outlets for those, if we're keeping our cats 100% indoors and we are not providing outlets, they are going to find their own outlets. And that can wreak havoc on a lot of families and a lot of homes that aren't prepared for that. But as we discussed in Chapter 3, the Feline Dream Home, there are ways to set this up to provide for those outlets that are hopefully not seen as being high maintenance or a burden, but really fun. They're trust building. They're ways to really enjoy the full spectrum of your cat's behavior and potential so that it doesn't feel like hard work or high maintenance. It's actually a pleasure. But it is something that I would caution people considering getting a cat to investigate and research that they are prepared to provide for those needs because particularly with kittens, they will find a way. And, you know, yes, there is some truth that as cats get older, most of them will, their energy levels calm down and that sort of constant need to play and scratch and climb does wane to some extent, but the need is still there and the social need too. Again, we talked about this earlier about cats being solitary. They're not social. A lot of our cats are extremely social and they're very sensitive to our schedules and our absences and that social need can be very, very high. And we need to provide for that. We need to spend time with our kitties. You know, as a veterinary behaviorist, we prescribe all sorts of treatments for cat behavior problems. And sometimes that includes an anti-anxiety medication. Often, almost always, it includes some sort of enrichment. But I can't tell you how many clients I've said to them, you know what, just sitting with your cat for 20 minutes twice a day is going to do you much more good than Prozac would. Because that one-on-one social time just meeting their needs is going to go way further in a lot of cases than a medication would.
So don't expect the cat to be aloof. And by the same token, don't you be aloof from the cat.
Absolutely. And again, there's variation in all personalities. And so kind of be prepared to accept your cat for who he or she is, because you don't quite know what you're getting, particularly if you're getting a kitten, until you live with them for quite a while and understand their unique individual personality.
Now, you mentioned briefly about cats not getting outside, and I know the cats are healthy if they stay inside. That's very clear in the book. We have the concerns of people like Bill and Sutherland, who called in earlier to talk about how cats kill millions of songbirds each year. I've seen billions of birds generally each year killed by cats. So if you recommend, it seems like the idea of some sort of outside space for the cat, like a catio or, you know, patio that's just for the cat.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, these cats have very normal natural behaviors that they would typically supplement through environmental enrichment outdoors, right? The trees to climb, the grass to chew, the mice and birds to hunt. I mean, those are normal natural behaviors for these natural predators and, you know, scratching. But we keep them indoors because we do have research that their lives are longer. They are healthier and they live longer. I mean, there are natural predators for cats. There are cars. There are infectious diseases they can get from getting in fights with other cats. There's a whole lot of risks for allowing your cat outdoors despite, you know, the great entertainment it might provide for them. And so there's a happy medium by creating these enclosures. So there are either, if you have a fence already in your backyard, there are cat fencing that you can put on the top of it that sort of arcs it in so they don't have the ability to climb out and over it. There's also the catios, and that can be as extensive or as minimal as you either can afford or have the handy work skills to put together. For example, some people will create a little, so it's like a screened-in porch that extends off a window. So you just leave a window cracked and you have sort of like just a little door so they can exit and you're not letting in cold or hot weather, but then they have this little space so they can go out. As opposed to, as you can see in our book, we have a couple of examples of these giant enclosures that are basically just screened in areas that have perching and shelving, because cats want to be up high. They love that high vantage point to watch prey and watch their environment around them. And so there's plenty of secure ways to do that, to provide that entertainment and enrichment, at least to some extent, while keeping them safe and protecting the songbird population.
Okay, high is really important. And there's quite a few, as I mentioned, pictures in the book and pictures of structures inside the house that are places really just for the cats to play, you know, shelves and stairs of their own and stuff like that, that you can build onto your walls to give them a place to perch and do that looking up from high thing. Let's take some calls here. Not surprisingly, you got a few going. Ron and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Megan Herron, the co-editor of Decoding Your Cat.
Thanks. My wife has a devil cat. I call it hers because it's a devil cat. And this devil cat loves to scratch up the furniture. And the cat knows. The cat knows a cat will go up and put the claws up on the couch and turn and look at me and sees me. And man makes a beeline straight for the cat door and outside as quick as it can because it knows it's in trouble as soon as I start to get up. And I'm thinking, what is with this cat?
All right, so let's see if we can get to the bottom of this. Thanks for the call, Ron. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think your devil cat might actually be a normal cat. So cat scratching a cat is a normal, actual necessary behavior. So cats have to scratch so that they release the outer layers of their nails. If they don't have the ability to do that, their nails will get really gnarly and big, and they will ingrow into their pads. So they have to do that from a physical standpoint. But then it's also a communication standpoint. So they seek out that couch because of the material and the height and because it's in a core area where they feel comfortable and they're often resting. So that tends to be the most desirable location for scratching. And they want to leave those messages. It's a normal, natural behavior, both visually and, again, to scent mark there. Even if there aren't any other cats in the house, it's still something they want to communicate how they're feeling that day. And they like to leave these visual marks in their environment. Again, their core area we talk about a lot in the book, which is a place where they eat, they sleep, they rest, and they hang out. That's their comfort zone, and that's where you're going to find scratching takes place. And it also sounds like your cat has normal learning pattern of, if I am caught, if my dad looks at me and I've got my claws here, there's going to be a negative consequence for me. So he's going to run away from you. But the drive is still there, right? That tells you how strong that drive is to scratch. But even though he knows there may be a negative consequence, if he does this in the same year, he's still willing to take that risk because the drive is so intense. Now, I will say there are cats that have learned that I will get attention from certain behaviors, even if it's negative attention. Some of them, it can be a learned behavior. But I would recommend looking at different scratching options that are as similar to your couch as possible, meaning same height, same texture, and place them same location, so very close to that. If your scratching post is short and of a different texture and in a completely different room, it's not going to have much appeal. And so we talk about some strategies in this book about, you know, there are some double-sided tapes you can place in the areas where they've been scratching and how to place a really appealing option for them close to that. There's also a pheromone product called Feel-A-Scratch, which you can place on your scratching post, which sort of says, hey, scratch me here. Investigate this here. So there's a lot you can do. So that devil cat can actually just be a normal cat and hopefully not be afraid of you and have to bolt every time he goes to sharpen his claws.
Yeah, thanks for sharing the story of devil cat, Ron. Let's go on to Linda in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, good morning. I am really enjoying your guest today. My husband and I love
you.
Cats.
Mm-hmm.
And my question for you is, we have a 19-year-old cat and an 18-year-old cat. Incidentally, they're both indoor kitties. The 19-year-old is a little bit more frail than the 18, and my husband and I are concerned if the 19-year-old passes away before the 18-year-old, we're concerned about the grief that she's going to have because she loves her so much. Mm-hmm. What do you suggest or help us, as this happens, what's the best way to help your cat handle grief?
All right. Interesting question. Thanks for that, Linda.
That's a really good question. I think it's often under-recognized that cats and dogs absolutely grieve, particularly if they have been lifelong companions for that long. And kudos to you for keeping healthy cats to 18 and 19 years of age. I mean, they certainly can live that long if they are, you know, well cared for and, you know, hopefully, you know, dodge any, you know, terrible, you know, illnesses that can sometimes happen to cats despite our best efforts. But yes, I think people ask me how to prepare and should I get a younger cat now? And I'd say that the older kitties probably don't want a young 8-week-old kitten to bother them. I think it's going to be a nuisance to them. but I think what I tell people to do is, if you're sensing a decline of one of the cats and you feel like that absence is imminent, then I tell people to start inserting just a miniature routine that involves you and doesn't involve the other cat, so that it's something positive for them. It's something predictable for them, maybe happens around the same time every day or a couple times a day, so that they have something to look forward to. And then when the inevitable happens and they lose that companion, they still have this part of their routine that had nothing to do with that other friend. And so it allows them to sort of have a reason to get up, to come close to you and look forward to that, and it's still familiar to them. But also, don't be alarmed if for the first few days, even week or so, your cat isn't as interested in that routine anymore. It's normal for them to grieve. It's okay for them to grieve. You really want to make sure that they're eating, because it's not safe for cats to go more than a day or two without eating. But sometimes grief can decrease appetite. If that starts to happen and it's prolonged, you definitely want to talk to your veterinarian about some interventions you can do to keep that appetite up. But I'd say it's normal for a week or two of grief, and it should start to wane, particularly if you're able to insert yourself in part of that daily routine, which you probably already are. But make sure you carve some special time that doesn't involve the other cat. And you, to be honest, you could do it with both kitties, because at 18 and 19 years old, you may not be able to predict who's going to go first. But yes, grief is normal. It's expected, and most cats recover within a week or two.
Another quick question in our final 2 minutes for Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. You know, medicine recommends that pregnant women don't touch cat poop because there's an associated dangerous brain parasite, Toxoplasmosis gondii. And I wonder if you could comment about crazy cat lady syndrome and the link with possible causes of dementia, psychosis, and schizophrenia.
Okay. Thanks for the question, Jacob. Is there such a thing?
Well, I have never heard of that before. I mean, it's an excellent point you make about toxoplasmosis. And sadly, a lot of pregnant women are told to get rid of their cats, which really isn't necessary. So the way to get toxo is if you actually handle with your bare hands fresh cat poop from a cat that's infected with toxoplasmosis, if it has to be at least 24 hours old, and you actually have a higher risk of getting toxoplasmosis through handling raw meat or through gardening than you do having a cat. So just having a cat really does not put you at risk. It's touching cat poop that is a day old. But I am not aware of that causing any sort of dementia or any sort of cognitive issues having cats. So crazy cat lady, I think it's just a myth or potentially something associated with, we assume people who have, you know, 20 cats may be crazy, but again, a lot of people, it's not too many cats until it's one too many cats is what I always say. But interesting question. I don't have a great answer for you other than it is safe for pregnant women to have cats.
Okay. I'm looking at that. I just got Googled crazy cat lady syndrome and got the first thing that came up was Wikipedia saying that it's a term coined by news organizations. But then there's another one that says from medical myth to potential what? Okay, this one's taking slow to load. But anyway, we learned a lot about cats in the book. We got a final email here from I grew up in New York City in an apartment in the 50s with a Siamese cat who never went out but used to watch the world from the windows. I had a parakeet who'd walk on my cat. She had never been outside and never been around birds. She was even a bit afraid of him. We were invited to appear on the Wing and Fin TV show with our cat and bird. That from Samantha, no town given, but thanks for a final capper there. The book is called Decoding Your Cat. The ultimate experts explain common behaviors and reveal how to prevent or change unwanted ones. Edited by Megan Heron, Deborah Horwitz, and Carlos Siragusa, with 21 authors from the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. Megan Heron's been our guest today on The Exchange, and thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, good to have you. That'll do it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. The Takeaway follows the program in the morning. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC after the interlude of Stardate. The Exchange is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Love on your cat and your dog. Join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.